On this week's 51%.
As a group, LGBT people experience increased stress and stigma from living as sexual and gender minorities. And the responses to that often increase our cancer risks.
The founder of the National LGBTQ Cancer Network says a more inclusive medical community can encourage more screenings. Hear how troubled pregnancies could mean years of health problems. And the political stage drives a singer-songwriter into the recording studio. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. We begin with Dr. Sharon Ufberg and her 51% segment, Force of Nature. This time, she interviews Liz Margulies, who's the founder and executive director of the National LGBTQ Cancer Network. This New York City-based organization educates the LGBT community about their cancer needs and the importance of screening for early detection. Margulies travels the country educating healthcare providers about how to offer more culturally responsive, safe, and welcoming care to their LGBT patients. And she advocates for LGBT inclusion in national cancer organizations, research, and the media. Margulies begins with how she came to found the National LGBT Cancer Network.
I've been a psychotherapist since a year after I graduated from social work school, and I really loved it, and I even considered it political work. I thought I was changing the world one soul at a time. And I maintain my private practice because it does mean so much to me still. But when I was in my 50s, four of my really close friends, like four of my favorite people on the entire planet, got ovarian cancer. And I watched in horror as they went through treatment and all four of them died. And I began to think that this was probably not bum luck or a poor choice of friends on my part, but maybe there was something going on. And all these four people were lesbians or identified as queer. And I began to do some research and found that as a group, LGBT people, meaning all subpopulations of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community, have increased cancer risks, lower screening rates, and extra challenges in survivorship. And I was horrified, but also really fascinated. Of course, I knew nothing about how to start a nonprofit organization, so I did what everybody would do. I took my dog and went to Barnes & Noble and sat in the How to Start a Nonprofit aisle several weekends in a row, and then began to talk to people to see what was needed and how we could make a difference. And then in 2008, we started the National LGBT Cancer Network, and here we are still today.
I'm just wondering why you found that the LGBT community had this increased need or higher rates of cancer. I know that's part of what was so horrifying for you to discover. Now that you've been working in the network for so many years, can you explain a little bit about why these are showing up as increased rates of cancer for that, for your particular community?
Well, it's a really good question because most people know this line, cancer doesn't discriminate, and just assume that that cancer would be the same. But actually, it falls under what we call the social determinants of health. So we know, for example, that people with broken BRCA genes are not necessarily the only people getting breast or ovarian cancer. That heredity is one thing, but there are also things about how we live our lives that increase or decrease our risks for cancer. So I'll start with this. It's not because our bodies are any different. But as a group, LGBT people experience increased stress and stigma from living as sexual and gender minorities. And the responses to that often increase our cancer risks. For example, LGBT people use tobacco at rates that are 63% higher than the general population. And tobacco is the cause of multiple types of cancer. Similarly, we drink and use drugs more as a group than the mainstream population. Also, with gay men, we see increased risks for or increased incidence of HPV, the human papillomavirus, which causes a variety of cancers, including anal cancer and esophageal cancers. Lesbians as a group are more likely to be overweight or eat a high-fat diet and less likely to have a biological child before age 30, which would offer some protection. In fact, they say that as a group, lesbians have the densest cluster of risk factors: increased smoking, drinking, high-fat diet, and less likely to have a child. And there's no other group that has increased rates of all of those. But can I actually tell you that we have more cancer? I can't. Even though I know that we smoke at much higher rates, I can't tell you that we have one more incident of lung cancer, for example, because there are national registries which collect information about every tumor that's found in everybody. And this is a very important source for research. It's one of the ways we know, for example, that white women are more likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer, but black women are more likely to die from it. But while all the LGBT tumors are in this registry, I can't get any of that data out because none of it has been marked with sexual orientation or gender identity, so we're hidden in the data. So do I have reason to believe we have increased cancer rates? Absolutely. And there's some secondary evidence to suggest that. And that's because we have increased risks, as I was just talking about, coupled with decreased screening rates. The reason we're less likely to get screened is because, as a group, LGBT people have far lower insurance rates, insurance coverage rates, that's what I mean. We're twice as likely to be uninsured, and many people have experienced discrimination or just negative experiences in the healthcare system, and so they avoid it at all cost. Of course, once you have cancer, there's no avoiding it. You're like thrust in, ready or not, head first into the medical system.
Can you talk a little bit about how the National LGBT Cancer Network might be doing some things to try to change some of this? I mean, tell us what you actually are doing.
Well, I think we have to work on several things at once, and so we are. We need to educate the community about our increased risks and the importance of screening and early detection. But I can't do that without acknowledging that there's a reason that my community has avoided the healthcare system. So at the same time, we have to educate healthcare providers to offer more culturally competent, safe, and welcoming care. So one of the things we do is maintain a directory on our website of LGBT welcoming, either free or low-cost cancer screening facilities across the country. Because let's just imagine a transgender man who has not had top surgery, but he's very unlikely to go get a mammogram because he's going to have to sit in the room of only women, many of them in little pink robes. So to encourage trans men to get mammograms, we have somebody on our directory. We've located many facilities that have someone who will accompany this person and make sure that he gets the first appointment of the day and he's not asked to sit in a room where he's the only man, for example. The same is true for transgender men and cervical pap screening. They're very unlikely to go to a gynecologist. So we're trying to set up alternative ways to take pap smears and test for HPV, which is a very good way to test for cervical cancer. We're both trying to get mainstream facilities to be more LGBT welcoming, and we're also trying to come up with alternatives for screening.
I was going to ask along the same, you know, subject, that the issue of having the LGBT community have to disclose their sexual orientation at the time of the screening and, you know, the issues around safety doing so, is that an issue that you're also trying to address with just the medical community in general that deals with cancer patients?
Well, that's a really good question because I think most people assume that LGBT people don't want to come out and that if asked, they might even deny it. But there was a fascinating study that was done in an emergency room last year, and they asked LGBT people, if you were asked about your sexual orientation and gender identity, would you be willing to disclose it? And 90% of them said that they would, meaning only 10% would not feel comfortable in an emergency room, which is where we're usually the most vulnerable. Then they asked the providers, the healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, physicians, assistants, et cetera, would you ask? And 77% of them said, no, it would be too intrusive. Nobody wants to tell me. So the point is, do ask us. We do want to tell. Because you can't know me unless you know some important things about me, which include my gender identity and sexual orientation. If I'm just checking off single on a form, you would get the wrong impression about me. I am in a committed partnership. And if something is found that's malignant or just worrisome, I want you to know who should be in the room when you tell me that, and that should be my partner. So we want to include people's what we call families of choice. It could be a best friend. It could be a partner. It could be an ex-partner. We want to know who people's support systems are. So we train providers to ask in a comfortable way, and we encourage them also to change their forms so that we can tell them on a form. If I go to a doctor's office and the form only has male and female, that's not very welcoming to trans and gender non-binary people. And if the only choices for marital status are single, married, widowed, divorced, you're not really going to capture people like me. And that gives a message before I even go in and speak to the provider that you don't really know about people like me. And maybe I'll be brave and bring it up, but really you should be asking me first in your form, and maybe have a rainbow sticker out there that tells me I'm not the only one that's ever been in this office, and then verbally.
I think this is such an important issue, and I'm wondering if you could share how people can find you, how they can hear more about what you're doing, perhaps who they can reach out to in their own communities that are part of your network. Can you tell us a little bit about ways that people can tap into the resources that you do have and connect with those of you in the National LGBT Cancer Network?
Sure. We have a website that has the directory and a lot of information that are things that you could print out and bring to your doctor with you that are just for you. We even have a personalized cancer risk report where you can answer a bunch of questions and it will print out a report telling you what you might be at increased risk for. And then again, we have the directory if you want to follow up with some screening. The website can be found at www.cancer-network.org. That's cancer-network.org. Or write to me. You can write to me directly, liz@cancer-network.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook, where we are always posting new information and reports and articles and things that everybody can use.
Thank you so much, Liz Margulies from the LGBT Cancer Network. And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. Across the United States, an alarming number of women die during pregnancy or childbirth, and for each one who dies, dozens wind up with health problems that can last for years. Now, women are being encouraged to watch what's happening in the, quote, fourth trimester. Side Effects Public Media's Lauren Bavis has the story of one mother's long struggle to get healthy.
After a traumatic delivery, an emergency C-section, Melody Lynch Kimmery had to spend a week in the hospital. She went home thinking her delivery complications were resolved. About 3 months later, she started to feel pain in her lower abdomen.
It's just randomly one day I started to have a lot of burning, just a lot of cramping, a lot of pain around my scar area.
That was more than 2 years ago. But the 39-year-old is still feeling the effects of her delivery. Every few weeks, she travels from Bloomington, where she's a student advisor at Indiana University, to see a physical therapist in Indianapolis.
We'll go ahead and lie down, and we'll just kind of we'll do some of the soft tissue stuff first, and then we'll, like I said, we'll head upstairs and we'll exercise a little bit.
Camille Fenwick starts the appointment massaging the 6-inch scar across Lynch Kimmery's lower abdomen. It's from the C-section and is now surrounded by scar tissue.
So I'm kind of going across that scar and kind of getting those little muscles kind of around it to kind of help it to loosen up a little bit.
Fenwick describes the scar tissue like shrink wrap. It binds to the tissue underneath, which causes pain when moving.
And I'm kind of feeling for like any little stuck kind of places, or check and see as far as pain, you know, that she may have while I'm doing it.
Chronic pain is just one of the health problems women struggle with after giving birth. Serious health issues can come from complications like high blood pressure and diabetes.
Both of these conditions are associated with basically a doubling in their lifelong risk for cardiovascular disease.
That's Dr. Lisa Ollier. She's president of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She says some healthy women develop high blood pressure and diabetes during pregnancy. Most of the time, these complications clear up after delivery. But research shows those women have higher risks of heart disease, diabetes, and stroke, even after they give birth.
What we're seeing is that pregnancy can act as sort of a natural stress test.
These women also face mental health risks.
Some situations, like having a preterm birth or a baby who goes to the neonatal intensive care unit, are also associated with a mom developing postpartum depression.
The problem is, not all women seek medical care after delivery. Women are told to see their doctor between 6 and 12 weeks after having a baby. But 20 to 40% of women don't go to that appointment.
We really believe that to best optimize the health of women, the postpartum care should really be a process, not a visit.
Now, the College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists wants women to get postpartum care sooner. New recommendations suggest women see their doctor 3 weeks after giving birth, or even earlier.
Women with high blood pressure, for example, are often seen within the first 5 to 7 days after the delivery.
And experts say postpartum care should continue long after that doctor's visit. They call it the fourth trimester. Susan Groth is a professor at the University of Rochester in New York. She's studying whether pregnancy can have an even longer impact. The study will follow healthy women 3 years after delivery.
Does pregnancy make a difference in their health, or is that really just this incident that happens and then everybody goes back to normal?
Getting back to normal isn't easy for all new moms. Lynch Kimmery isn't sure how long she'll need therapy for the scar tissue pain from the birth of her daughter, Sawyer.
I'd love to be free of it. I'd love to not have to worry about it.
For now, she's making the best of a health problem she never anticipated. I'm Lauren Bavis, Side Effects Public Media.
A New York City-based singer-songwriter is making a plea for unity in Congress. Annie Dinerman has written adult R&B and old-school R&B with a contemporary touch. But her latest song enters the realm of politics. Dinerman says she subscribes to the power of traditional R&B and gospel lyrics, fewer words chosen for strong impact, and repeating key phrases. Though she has written environmental songs, she talks about what led her to write a more political song, Across the Aisle.
I have written music for social change in the past, but it's been a while. And recently, I guess it was in December, January, someone said to me, why don't you write a song about a current issue? And we had a conversation, and I determined that the issue that most interested me was divisiveness and unity. And my friend said, yeah, he thought that was a really great issue to write about. So based on that, I made a list of 15 song ideas. And then went back to my friend, and this was the one he liked the best. So on his advice, I wrote this one. And I must have really wanted to write it because it just it just kind of came out of me.
Dinerman says there were some rewrites.
The first version of the second verse was just a list of the issues that were dividing Congress with no rhymes. And then I thought, maybe that's where people are going to go. Check, please. So then I thought it really has to be about how people are feeling. And, you know, I'm watching people having all sorts of reactions on Facebook every day. And I just tried to encapsulate that. I just tried to say, look, well, this is, you know, how people are feeling, and put that in the song.
How do you feel?
Well, as it says, I'm embarrassed and afraid, and I read the tweets and I'm dismayed.
Each day we're embarrassed and afraid. We're reading the tweets, we're dismayed. And while you're stalling, history's waiting to be made across the aisles.
The recipient of the A. Bowman Award from the Songwriters Hall of Fame hopes listeners are spurred to act.
I'm hoping that people will hear the song because the song is from the point of view of voters addressing Congress and asking for unity. And I'm hoping people will hear the song and send a link to the song at my website to their congressman, their representative.
Asked whether the song is looking to the 2020 presidential election.
I'm thinking about today. I understand where you're headed there with that question. I'm not even addressing the next election or who's going to be the candidate for the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. I just want them to start working together for the greater good. There are some classic examples of politicians who had long-standing friendships across the aisle and achieved things. And I think that's been, till this administration, that's been an important part of the process, of the legislative process. But the atmosphere is so extreme now, and a lot of people are afraid, and a lot of people are embarrassed.
She says there is a long list of issues of concern, for starters.
You know, money being taken away from Medicare, the border wall, parents being separated from children at the border seem like some of the most important issues at this point.
Dinerman talks about a 2011 workshop that speaks to her environmental efforts.
When I was making environmental music, Rex Benincasa and I created a workshop called the Garbage Percussion Workshop, and we got a small grant from the Music to Life Foundation to go to a university and do the workshop and shoot a video. And we were mostly concerned with educating people to have good environmental habits in their daily lives, because people tend to think, well, it's just my garbage, how it doesn't matter. But if everybody thinks that, then we're living in a garbage dump. So we were just trying to get people to think about repurposing by teaching them to play music rhythms on instruments that were really just things from the recycle bin. And I guess in my estimation, I thought things were going to be much further along with the mainstream relationship with environmental protection. So it's sad to see people undermining science, but it's also sad to see people undermining journalism.
That was singer-songwriter Annie Dinerman talking about her latest song, Across the Aisle, calling for political unity in Congress.
Someone has answers. It's time to reconcile. Why would you build a wall when you can reach across the aisle?
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1549.